First of all, I just want to begin by the learning today is dedicated in memory of Meir and Sylvia Zeifman. Zichronam Lebracha. Meir Zeifman used to come to this program every year. He was very close to us, and his children are dedicating the program in his memory. They also asked me to mention Rabbi Asher Turin, who passed away a couple years ago, also used to come every year to the program. And as I always say, whenever we dedicate learning in memory of someone, there's no greater way to memorialize a person than through learning. Learning and charity. Kaddish is lower. It's a way learning connects us to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it links the temporary and divine. And it's really, it's the best way to moralize somebody. The learning should be in the schut of all of us, in the schut of Klal Yisrael. It's also, it's a little hard to believe, but this is the 32nd year that we've put on this, you know, program. I went to university in New York, in Yeshiva University, and they had this in Flatbush for a couple years. They had this all-day program on Tisha B'Av. I moved back to Toronto in 1988, and I went out of my mind the first year on Tisha B'Av. There was not one thing in the whole city, nothing. So in 1989, I decided to organize a program, and here we are 31 years later, whatever it was, 88 days. So I just, it's, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, so many years on Tisha B'Av, but really over the years, so many wonderful speakers, and Tisha B'Av has become, my wife claims, sort of my favorite holiday of the year. That's not exactly true, but I find that Tisha B'Av is really a very meaningful day, and it can be an extremely inspiring day. Those of you who heard Rabbi Pearl this morning, the keynote are really beautiful and tragic at the same time. The poetry, the elegy, the emotion, and the goal of Tisha B'Av is to get us to move beyond, just like on Yom Kippur, Vayehi Mimacharat, what's after. So we should have, for the rest of the afternoon, I hope that we can be inspired through the various speakers, and we can look inwards through our nechamas. Rabbi Pearl spoke on Shabbos that we should be a changed person after Tisha B'Av. With that, sir, a little bit longer than I have planned to go, it's really a pleasure to introduce Rabbi Pearl, who was with us all of Shabbat, and we really had him here again because he was so powerful last year, and he'll be leaving right after his talk. He has to catch an airplane, so don't try to talk to him afterwards, and we really want to thank him for all your efforts. Bakasha, Rabbi Pearl.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman, and thank you to the entire community for inviting me back to share a second Tisha B'Av with you. As you probably can tell, somehow between yesterday and today, I've contracted some laryngitis, and while, as I said this morning, it's certainly not the greatest tragedy to befall the Jewish people on Tisha B'Av, I am sorry that you have to suffer through listening to my voice, but I'd like to explore a very interesting topic with you, something that came to my attention and piqued my interest that I pursued and actually was rather fascinated by what I discovered. So hopefully everybody has a source sheet, right, the stapled sheets. If you don't, if we could try to distribute them such so that everyone has access to it, it'll be very helpful as we go through the material. So Tisha B'Av, as you know, is a day of tragedy. And in the Kinos, we move through and touch on the different tragedies throughout Jewish history. But the Mishnah begins by stating that there are five tragedies that had happened at that point in history. So we take a look at the Mishnah. The Mishnah Maseches Tanis says, Chamisha Dvarim Yiru Es Avoseinu B'Shivasar B'Tamuz V'Chamisha B'Tisha B'Av. There were five tragedies by the time of the Mishnah that had occurred on the 17th of Tammuz and five that occurred on the 9th of Av. The Mishnah goes on to list those that occurred on the 17th of Tammuz. That's not our topic for discussion today. But says the Mishnah B'Tisha B'Av Nigzar Al Avoseinu Shelo Yikansu La'aretz V'Charav Habayis Barishonah Uvashniya, Vinil Kida Beitar. The first four tragedies are very familiar to us. Number one, the Jewish people turned their back on the land of Israel when it was initially presented to them as a gift, and God said, we're going to send representatives, not really spies, but representatives of the Jewish people to see the beautiful land that I've given you. They come back, and the Jewish people say, no thank you. A travesty, a disaster, one that results in the death of that entire generation in the desert. That's the first tragedy of Tisha B'Av. Next, as we know, the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash and the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. Fourth, the defeat at Beitar, the Bar Kokhba revolt, and its subsequent defeat at Beitar, the massacre of the Jewish forces at Beitar. And as I noted this morning, just very powerful to realize that when the battle was lost at Beitar, that was the last time a Jewish army fought for the Jewish people and for the land of Israel until 1948. From 135 of the Common Era, the defeat of Beitar, until 1948. Those four tragedies are relatively familiar to us. But then the Mishnah lists the fifth tragedy of Tisha B'Av, and it's two simple words. It says, Nechresha Ha'ir, which is translated as the city was plowed. And the question is, what exactly does that mean? What tragedy occurred? What does it refer to? What monumental event in Jewish history is to be observed and mourned on the 9th of Av that's known as the plowing of the city? Interestingly enough, the commentaries are rather mute about this, especially when you compare the volumes of material that are offered to explain the first four tragedies. So two of the staple commentaries on the Mishnah offer, again, very little to clarify what exactly this fifth tragedy is. If you look at your source sheet, the Tosfos Yom Tov, Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller in the 17th century, one of the great commentaries on the Mishnah, simply says on the phrase Venech Resha Ha'ir, that the city was plowed, he refers to a pasuk from Yirmiyahu that says, Tzion Sadeh Techerash. It predicts that Tzion, Yerushalayim, will be plowed like a city, like a field. Shenech Resha Kula V'na'aseis Kisadeh Harusha. That the city will be plowed over. What do you mean plowed over? It will be made so desolate like a barren field. But interestingly enough, he doesn't really tell us when that actually happens. He just refers to the prophecy that says that it will happen. The next commentary in the Mishnah, the Tiferet Yisrael, Rabbi Yisrael Lifshitz, he says, at least he gives us an event, something that happened in Jewish history. He says, She'achar churban bayit rishon, hayisa eretz Yisrael midbar shmama, nun bet shanim. After the destruction of the first temple, the land of Israel became desolate for 52 years. V'Yerushalayim atzma, and the city of Yerushalayim itself, na'aseis shaveh le'adama kisadeh harusha. And the city of Yerushalayim itself also became desolate and barren, like a plowed field. So at least the Tiferet Yisrael has given us some historical event that can be dated, right? It's following the first temple, and we'll discuss this a little bit more. At least we're moving towards some clarity. Yes, and I please feel free to ask questions. Great. We're going to ask a whole series of questions, and that's going to be one of them. So just hold on to that for 1 minute. We've learned before, haven't we? Okay. Next, we turn to the historian of the time period for greater clarity about what it means that the city was plowed over. Says Josephus, Wars of the Jews, you have it in your source material. Thus Jerusalem was taken in the second year of the reign of Vespasian on the eighth day of the month of Gorpius. It had been taken five times before, though this was the second time of its desolation. So Josephus, of course, is reporting on the destruction of the second temple in the year 70 of the Common Era. It was demolished entirely by the Babylonians. This was the first time, 477 years and 6 months after King David. From King David, who was the first of the Jews who reigned therein, to this destruction under Titus were 1,179 years. Yet hath not its great antiquity, nor its vast riches, nor the diffusion of its nations over all the habitable earth, nor the greatness of the veneration paid to it on a religious account, been sufficient to preserve it from being destroyed. Says Josephus, as great a city as Jerusalem had been, it was not spared from destruction at the hands of Titus, again in the year 70 CE. Says Josephus, thus ended the siege of Jerusalem. Right? The process of the Romans conquering Jerusalem was an elongated process, but it eventually ended with the city's destruction. Says Josephus, continuing to report the history after the destruction of the temple. As soon as the army had no more people to slay or to plunder, Vespasian gave orders that they should now demolish the entire city and temple, but should leave as many of the towers standing as were of the greatest eminency. Okay, so he ordered the destruction of the city, but he said, leave the greatest towers of the city and the city walls. Why? In order to demonstrate to posterity what kind of city it was and how well fortified, which the Roman valor had subdued. Leave some of the greatest towers standing so that the rest of civilization will see what a powerful city this was, and yet the Romans were able to conquer it. He continues, but for the rest of the wall, it was so thoroughly laid even with the ground by those who dug it up to the foundation that there was left nothing to make those that came thither believe it had ever been inhabited. This was the end which Jerusalem came to by the madness of those who were for innovations, a city otherwise of great magnificence and mighty fame among all mankind. Okay, so Titus, Vespasian, ordered the rest of the city, other than these towers, to be completely razed to the ground, such that what was left was essentially a barren, desolate area, which was hard to even imagine that anyone had lived there before. That's the description that Josephus gives. He then went down with his army to Caesarea, which lay by the seaside, and there laid up the rest of his spoils in great quantities, and gave order that the captives should be kept there, for the winter season hindered him then from sailing into Italy. So the sequence of events, the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple, the razing of the walls and the city so that nothing was left. Vespasian takes captives. He takes the spoils of Jerusalem and of the Beit HaMikdash. He brings those to Caesarea, which was the Roman capital in Judea. But he has to stay there because we've gone from the 9th of Av to the few months that follow. That's the post-history here. Then it's winter time. Winter time in the Mediterranean is the rainy season and the stormy season. So we're now into the fall, and Vespasian has to remain in Caesarea until the end of the winter and the rainy season. So now we have three perspectives on what the plowing of the city means. The first, which really didn't refer to any event, just a prophecy that it would happen. The Tiferet Yisrael tells us that it refers to the desolation of the city following the first Beit HaMikdash. Josephus describes a scenario in which the city was laid bare to its foundations following the second Beit HaMikdash. Right. That's what we have to work with. If you look at the top of page 2, there are a number of problems that arise from each of these explanations, okay? Number one, it would seem, based on these explanations, to be a very poor choice of words that the Mishnah uses. The phrase that the Mishnah uses is nechresha ha'ir. The root, chet reishin, is an agricultural word. It means, and it's used quite often, it means to plow. It's a process of preparing a field for laying seed. If the what if what we are referring to is the destruction of a city, and even if it's laying it bare, raising it to the ground, there are many other words that would have been more appropriate to use. There are no shortage of words for destruction. We've encountered many of them over the course of Tisha B'Av and the keynote and Eicha. No shortage of such words. And yet, the Mishnah uses specifically an agricultural word to describe what happened to the city. Number two, this Mishnah is describing five monumental events, tragic events that took place on the day of Tisha B'Av. It's very hard to take any of the explanations that we've been given so far and turn those into a single monumental tragic event. I understand that Tiferet Yisrael is saying that the fate of the city after the first temple was that it lay in ruins, understood. And Josephus describes a process by which the city of Yerushalayim and the temple are laid to the foundation. Okay, so what happened on the 9th of Av in this process? What happened on the 9th of Av that becomes the fifth tragedy that we are to mourn for the rest of Jewish history? Number three, the chronology seems to be wrong. In the Mishnah, thus far, the tragedies have been described in chronological order, starting with Chet HaMeraglim, the sin of the spies in the desert, the destruction of the first temple, the destruction of the second temple, the crushing and massacre of the revolt at Beitar. Those are all in chronological order. The fifth is Nechresha Ha'ir. None of the accounts that we've been given thus far happened after Beitar. Right, the Tiferet Yisrael says it refers to the city's desolation after the first temple. Josephus says it refers to the raising of the city after the second temple, but immediately after the second temple. Why does the Mishnah list this fifth tragedy as the last in a series? And if in fact it's the last in a series, are we missing something? Is there another explanation that's thus far eluded us? And then finally, fourth, which is the question that Joey asked at the very beginning, the dating seems to be wrong here. Again, the Mishnah says that these five things occurred on Tisha B'Av. Okay, if we work with Josephus's account, this process of laying the city to ruin and bringing down the walls most certainly did not happen on Tisha B'Av, because on Tisha B'Av they entered the Beit HaMikdash, they set it afire, right? We know that, we've spoken about it over the course of Tisha B'Av. Josephus is very clear that maybe a month or so later, Titus orders the raising of the city. It's a process that leads him into the fall, right? Until he lands up with his troops in Caesarea, where he has to wait out the winter. So why does the Mishnah say that Nechresha Ha'ir, this act of plowing over the city, occurred on Tisha B'Av? So I'd like to share with you a very different approach to what exactly the fifth tragedy of Tisha B'Av is. After we explore a little bit, we'll come back and see if it helps us answer the four different questions that we asked. So to begin with, we have to understand something about the founding of the city of Rome and the subsequent founding of Roman colonies. Now, the word colonies used in a Roman context doesn't have the same connotation as it may have for us for American history. Colony means a proper Roman city. That's what a colony means. So let's take a look at some of this historical material. This is from an academic article by Arthur Eckstein, comes from the California Studies in Classical Antiquity from 1981. So take a look, we'll look at the arrows, that's where we'll start. Says Professor Eckstein, the ancient evidence makes it clear that the same plowing ritual by which Romulus was supposed to have formally founded Rome also occurred during the establishment of colonnae, and more importantly, was associated in the Roman mind precisely with the formal founding of the colony. A wide range of authors indicate that the plowing ritual was used whenever the Romans in general founded new cities, nova urbes. Our ancient evidence is abundant, uniform, and specific about this. Okay, so what is he saying? There is a legend that the way the city of Rome was founded was through some sort of a ritual of plowing, which we'll see in a little bit more specifics as we go on. But there was an act of plowing the boundary of the city, and that was the formal founding of Rome, and therefore, in ancient Rome, the Independence Day of Rome, right? The day in which the founding of Rome was celebrated was not the day the first building went up. It wasn't the day the first mayor was inaugurated or the emperor. It was the day of the founding ritual, the founding ritual being an act of plowing. Furthermore, all subsequent Roman colonies were founded through this particular plowing ritual. So let's go on. Finally, one may observe the frequency with which the aratrum ceremony, that's the plowing ceremony, is depicted on the coins of the colony. Now, in antiquity, the most important events that occurred in a particular reign of an emperor were always stamped on a coin, minted for posterity. It was actually, like today, we have, I don't know if we want to say live stream, we have e-blast, we have WhatsApp. That's how we let people know what's going on. In the ancient world, they minted coins with the most important events of the day. Because, interestingly enough, coins were the easiest thing to circulate, right? You just put them into circulation, and they traveled far and wide throughout the empire, and the coins would let people know about monumental events that had occurred. And so the plowing ritual, the foundation of Roman colonies, were actually represented on many of the coins in ancient Rome. This seems further evidence, continues Professor Eckstein, this seems further evidence of the close association in Roman minds between that ceremony and the existence of the colony. Meaning, if a city is created, the visual representation of the creation of a city was the depiction of the plowing ritual. The ancient evidence so far presented tells us uniformly and strongly in favor of the idea that the plowing ceremony was conceived of by the Romans as constituting the formal founding of Roman colony, and implies that the founding days celebrated yearly by Roman colony commemorated the day upon which that original plowing ceremony had taken place. We have seen this in the founding of Rome, celebrated every year at the Paralia Festival, was the archetype of the subsequent foundings of Roman towns. And that, the Paralia, specifically commemorated, according to all of our sources, the performance of the aratrum ceremony by Romulus. That ritual was considered the formal founding of the city. Similarly, the foundings of urbes novae, new cities, and of colonae in particular, are universally associated by our sources with the plowing of the ritual furrow around the prospective town site. Okay, so the ritual was on founding day of a Roman colony, the governor or the emperor, whoever the honorary figure was, would actually take a plow. There was a specific type of oxen. Jews are not the only ones that have very particular ways in which rituals are supposed to be done. Particular type of oxen that were to be yoked to this plow, and that government official would plow the boundary of the new city, and that was the way in which a city was founded. Okay, now let's come back to the history of Yerushalayim. So the Encyclopedia Britannica will introduce us to the Roman city, Aelia Capitolina. So bottom of page 2. Aelia Capitolina was a city founded in 135 by the Romans on the ruins of Jerusalem, which their forces under Titus had destroyed in the year 70. The name was given after the second Jewish revolt in honor of the Emperor Hadrian, whose nomen or clan name was Alias, hence the first part of the name of Alia, as well as the deities of the Capitoline Triad. There were three primary pagan gods of ancient Rome: Jupiter, Juno, and Minerva. That's the Capitoline Triad, okay? And hence the name Alia Capitolina, emphasizing Hadrian's greatness and the pagan deities of Rome. A large foreign population was imported. Jews were generally forbidden entrance to the city. So this is what happens around the time of the Bar Kokhba revolt. The city of Jerusalem, which, according to Josephus, had been laid to the ground, on that site, Hadrian founded and built a new city, which he called Alia Capitolina, in honor of himself and in honor of the Roman pagan gods. What would we expect to find, given what we've learned so far? We would expect the founding of such an important new Roman city to be captured and depicted in the coinage of that era. And that's exactly what we find. If you look at the top of page 3, so here you have a bronze coin, front and back, and you have kind of a sketch so that you can see in greater detail what appears on one of the sides of the coin. And let's see what this coin is all about. The small bronze city coin of Alia Capitolina, minted in 130 of the Common Era under the reign of Hadrian, depicts on the obverse the head of the emperor, which was standard. One side almost always had a depiction of the emperor. The other side, some significant event that occurred during the reign of that emperor. In this case, on the reverse was the ceremony of circumductio, which symbolized the foundation of the city as a colony. Thus, the emperor is depicted while plowing the pomerium of the city, the boundary, with an ox and a cow. The inscription in Latin on the reverse celebrates the foundation of the city of Alia Capitolina as Colonia Alia Capitolina Condita. Okay, and those are the words. They're abbreviated on the coin. Literally, those four words mean the foundation of the city of Alia Capitolina. So now I think we have a little bit better understanding of what the Mishnah meant when it referred to the plowing of the city. It wasn't the process of destroying the city, but rather the plowing of the city is essentially a euphemism for the foundation of a new city on the site of our city of Yerushalayim, a city called Alia Capitolina, which in the ancient world of Rome was symbolized, as the foundation of all cities were, by the plowing ritual. And this was the coinage that was circulated. And you can imagine the Jewish reaction to seeing a depiction of the plow and the emperor depicting the founding of a Roman city named for Hadrian and a triad of Roman pagan gods that was now erected on the site of their beloved Yerushalayim. And again, you have to understand what this would have done to the psyche of the Jewish people. The Jewish people had experienced tragedy before, and they had even experienced the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash once before. But after the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, what remained on the site of Yerushalayim? Anybody know? We actually have a very good idea. One thing we know for sure, no Babylonian city was constructed on the ruins of Jerusalem. When Nehemiah goes back some 70 plus years later to the city, he gives a very good description of what he finds there. And essentially, he finds the Jewish city in ruins. And he describes how he was able to pick out the gates that existed during the time of the Beit HaMikdash. Some of them were in disrepair. There were areas of the wall that were smashed down that he needed to rebuild. But essentially, the city of Yerushalayim remained, but it remained in ruins. No foreign entity had ever decided to replace our city of Yerushalayim with a city of their own until Hadrian did so following the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. And the pain that that must have caused the Jewish people, not just to have seen their city reduced to rubble, but to have seen the construction of a Roman pagan city on that very site, paying tribute to the emperor that had destroyed, that was persecuting the Jewish people and pagan gods, you can only imagine the pain that that would have caused the Jewish people. And if you think about it, so long as your city remains in ruins, it's easier to imagine a return and a rebuild. When that city is now built up by the Romans and has become a flourishing pagan city, it becomes all the more difficult to imagine how are we going to return to this city and once again have Yerushalayim as the capital of the Jewish people. So with this in mind, if you think about the challenges, the four questions, if you will, that we asked earlier, this new understanding of this, of what the plowing of the city means actually helps us answer all four questions. The first question that we asked was, why does the Mishnah use the language of plowing, which is an agricultural term, as opposed to the language of destruction? The language of plowing is very specific. It refers to an agricultural act. It refers to an agricultural ritual that was well known in Roman times, namely the founding of the city. Was it a tragic event? Absolutely. As we saw from the historical literature, the founding of the city was the day that was celebrated in posterity by the Romans, celebrated the independence and the founding of that city. That was a day that in the rest of the Roman world would have been a day of joy, and for the inhabitants of Aelia Capitolina would have been a day of celebration. That day, the very day of the founding of the city, was a tragic event in the history of Judaism. That brings us to the third question. The third question was that of chronology. So here we have to look at a very interesting historical debate. So our question is, the founding of Aelia Capitolina, we know it happened after the Chet HaMeraglim. We know it happened after the first destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. We know it happened after the second destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. The question that remains is, did the foundation of Aelia Capitolina happen before or after the Bar Kokhba revolt, right, the fall of Beitar? So let's take a look at the historical sources on page 3. The first one comes from the Roman historian Cassius Dio, who died in 235 of the Common Era. Cassius writes, "At Jerusalem, Hadrian founded a city in place of the one which had been razed to the ground, naming it Aelia Capitolina. This brought on a war of no slight importance nor of brief duration, for the Jews deemed it intolerable that foreign races should be settled in their city and foreign religious rites planted there. So long, indeed, as Hadrian was close by in Egypt and again in Syria, they remained quiet. But when he went farther away, they openly revolted. At first, the Romans took no account of them. Soon, however, all Judea had been stirred up, and Jews everywhere were showing signs of disturbance, gathering together and giving evidence of great hostility to the Romans. Then, indeed, Hadrian sent against them his best generals. First of these was Julius Severus, who was dispatched from Britain, where he was governor, against the Jews. Thanks to the number of his soldiers and under-officers, and by depriving them of food and shutting them up, he was able, rather slowly to be sure, but with comparatively little danger, to crush, exhaust, and exterminate them. Very few of them, in fact, survived. Thus, nearly the whole of Judea was made desolate. This, then, was the end of the war with the Jews." So according to Cassius, what happens first, the foundation of Aelia Capitolina or the Bar Kokhba revolt? Which happened first? The foundation of the city. In fact, he claims that it was the foundation of the city that served as the provocation for the revolt, right? The Jews seeing a Roman city being erected on the site of Yerushalayim, that's actually what provoked the revolt. Yes. No, the coin's not dated. The coin's not dated. It's for the historians to figure out when the, and we'll see. It says minted in 130. That's because that historian's position is based on this historical source that it was founded in 130, but we'll see. We'll see in 1 second. Turn the page. We would know a lot more if ancient coins had dates on them, similar to modern coins, but in generally speaking, they didn't have dates on them. They depicted events. Okay, the second primary historical source for this question comes from Eusebius. And Eusebius was a church father who lived a little bit later than Cassius. He died in 339 of the Common Era. He too writes a history, and this comes from chapter 6, the end of his account of what happened to the Jews. It's called The Last Siege of the Jews. Here's what he writes. As the rebellion of the Jews at this time grew much more serious, Rufus, governor of Judea, reduced their country to a state of complete subjection. The leader of the Jews at this time was a man by the name of Bar Kochva, which signifies a star, who boasted to them, as if they were slaves, that he possessed wonderful powers, and he pretended that he was a star that had come down to them out of heaven to bring them light in the midst of their misfortunes. The war raged most fiercely in the 18th year of Hadrian at the city of Betar, which was a very secure fortress not far from Jerusalem. When the siege had lasted a long time and the rebels had been driven to the last extremity by hunger and thirst, and the instigator of the rebellion had suffered his just punishment, the whole nation was prohibited from this time on by a decree and by the commands of Hadrian from ever going up to the country about Jerusalem. And thus, when the city had been emptied of the Jewish nation and had suffered the total destruction of its ancient inhabitants, it was colonized by a different race. And the Roman city, which subsequently arose, changed its name and was called Aelia, in honor of the emperor Aelius Hadrian. Eusebius presents, first of all, you can hear from his presentation, he has a certain slant on his presentation, and this is not atypical of history which was provided by the early church fathers. The early church fathers were determined to present a history which presented the Jews in not just a horrible light, but presented their misfortunes as being punishment for, of course, the treachery of the Jews at having killed Jesus. So this fits very, very clearly in a pattern of church father history. And essentially, what is Eusebius saying? According to Eusebius, when was the city of Aelia Capitolina founded? After the Bar Kokhba revolt, right? And he almost couches it as a punishment for the Jews, right, for everything that's happened up until that point. He sees Aelia Capitolina as the final stamp of the end of Judaism, probably in his mind, period, but certainly the end of Judaism in the Holy Land. So here you have two different historical accounts as to exactly when the city was founded. Now, nobody disagrees. The city was founded. It was founded by a plowing ritual. The coinage testifies to that. The question is, did it happen in the year 130? That's one historical account. And 130 would have been right before the Bar Kokhba uprising, which begins in about the year 132. Or does the founding take place afterwards, after the defeat of Bar Kokhba at Betar in approximately the year 135. And this is argued quite extensively. And interestingly enough, it's the discovery of a cache of coins that sheds a little bit more light on the dating question. Okay, and just to tie it into the relevance of our conversation, according to Cassius, How's the chronology in the Mishnah work? No, according to Cassius, it's still out of order, right? Because according to Cassius, the city was founded first, and then Beitar should have been number four. According to the second account, the chronology is now perfectly accurate, right? After Beitar comes the plowing of the city and the founding of Aelia Capitolina. So take a look at this last historical source here. Among the studies on Aelia Capitolina and its connection to the Temple Mount are those by Yaron Svi Eliav. One of the important conclusions he makes is that Aelia Capitolina did not include the Temple Mount and that it remained in its state of desolation. Eliav also does not accept the location of the pagan temple on the Temple Mount. So there is a disagreement between historical sources as to even when Hadrian founded Aelia Capitolina, we know that he erected a temple to Jupiter. The question is, did he put that temple on Har HaBayit, or was that temple located within the city? Now, archaeological evidence argues very strongly for the location of that temple being within the city because nothing has been found on Har HaBayit that gives evidence to a pagan temple ever having existed there. But it's a very interesting conversation. But let's take a look at the second paragraph. To complete the discussion about Aelia Capitolina as a possible cause for the outbreak of the revolt, it is necessary to discuss the foundation date of the colony. This will be done mainly on the basis of numismatic evidence. That means the study of coins. Already in 1967, Yaakov Mishorer noted, now follow the sequence because it's really fascinating to see how historians and archaeologists use coins and their discovery to try to put events in historical chronological order. In 1967, Yaakov Mishorer noted that in the archaeological plundering of Mount Hebron, a coin hoard was found dating to the period of the Bar Kokhba revolt and contained some coins from Aelia Capitolina. From these coins, Mishorer deduced that one should accept the words of Cassius, the Cassius Dio Ziphilinius summary regarding the city's founding in the year 130 of the Common Era before the outbreak of the revolt. How did it work? The discovery of these two Aelia Capitolina coins, together with coins minted during the course of the revolt, indicates that these coins were minted before the year 135 CE, right? If you find Aelia now it's never a guarantee, but for archaeologists, if you find what is some sort of a trove of coins, and you find coins from Aelia Capitolina together with coins that were minted as part of the Bar Kokhba revolt, the conclusion is that Aelia Capitolina was founded and its coins were minted before the Bar Kokhba revolt, okay? Whether or not it's definitive, it's certainly persuasive for historians, okay? So that leaves us with one question with regard to the chronology. Yeah. That's a good question. So at the end of that first paragraph, we'll do this very quickly. The question is, does the existence or non-existence of that pagan temple on Har HaBayit kind of change the dynamic or the discussion as to whether or not the city prompted the revolt? So it's a good question. So I skipped over this line because I didn't think we were going to cover it, but since you asked, it's a very good question. So in the opinion of this historian, Menachem Moore, he writes the last line in the first paragraph. Therefore, we can discount the founding of Aelia Capitolina as the main cause for the second revolt. Okay, so in his mind, if the pagan temple was not built on Har HaBayit, then just the creation of a pagan city on top of Yerushalayim, in his mind, would not have been sufficient provocation for the Jewish people to revolt. That's his opinion, right? And that speaks to your question. I personally disagree, and I think it fails to appreciate the attachment that we as a Jewish people have and have always had to the city of Yerushalayim. In my humble opinion, the mere construction of a Roman city dedicated to the persecuting emperor and dedicated by name to a pagan triad of gods, to me, would have been painful enough and offensive enough to the Jewish people to have provoked a revolt, even if Har HaBayit remained untouched. But we don't know. We don't know. But that's an interesting conversation. Okay, so let me suggest to you the following. If we take the account that the founding of Aelia Capitolina happened after Beitar, then the chronology of the Mishnah is perfectly fine. But if we accept the chronology of Cassius, which seems to be favored by archaeological and numismatic evidence, that the city was founded first and very shortly thereafter was the Bar Kokhba revolt, so then we have to ask ourselves, why is it that the Mishnah leaves the tragedy of the city was plowed over, which we understand as the foundation of Aelia Capitolina, why is that listed last in the Mishnah? Anybody wanna take a shot? Yeah, go ahead. Right, we've learned together, right? I think Joey is 100% correct. But we never discussed this before. If you think about it, each of the tragedies, they were tragic. There's no question about it. The destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, the massacre at Beitar. These were events that occurred, but then they were over. And when an event is over, people have the ability to move on, right? It takes an effort for us to look back and touch these events and be affected by them. But for those living in the time of the Mishnah, right, in the third century, the presence of Aelia Capitolina, a pagan city on the site of Jerusalem, would have been an ongoing tragedy, one that they were reminded of every single day, and one which probably caused them pain every single day. So I would suggest that even though historically the founding of the city may have occurred a few years before the revolt of Beitar, as far as the Mishnah was concerned, the last and current tragedy of Tisha B'Av was the presence of a pagan city on our beloved Jerusalem. Now, just to finish up, the last question that we had was, how is this event of the founding of the city, of Nechresh HaHa'ir, according to the Mishnah, this is one of the five things that occurred on Tisha B'Av. And admittedly, I don't have a very good answer for this. But here's what I do know. It's certainly more reasonable to think, and from the historical evidence that I've been able to get my hands on, no one narrows the founding of the city and the ritual to a specific date. I just don't think it's known, at least from what I've seen. But at least now that we have an event that happened and was commemorated every year, it's at least conceivable that this plowing ritual may have happened, in fact, on or around Tisha B'Av, which would have allowed the Mishnah to include it as one of the things that happened on Tisha B'Av, as it did some of the other tragedies which happen on or around the 9th of Av. So at least it's conceivable. There is one other possibility, and that is that the actual founding of the city of Aelia Capitolina is not necessarily known, nor was it known in the time of the Mishnah, but there was a very close association of the city to the 9th of Av. And that comes from a voluminous historical evidence that we have that when the Romans banned the Jews from this new city, which we know they did, Jews were not allowed in Aelia Capitolina, they made one exception. And it's hard to know whether it was a compassionate exception or a cruel exception. The exception was that once a year, the Jewish people were allowed to come to the city so that they could look at what had become of Jerusalem, and they could look at the ruins of Har HaBayit. And we have ample evidence, some from Jewish sources and some from Christian sources, of the Jews coming to Aelia Capitolina every year on the 9th of Av. And so I would suggest it's possible that even if the city wasn't founded on the 9th of Av, in the minds of the Jewish people who were not allowed any contact with this city the whole year round, the only day on which they were permitted to lay eyes on this Aelia Capitolina was every year on Tisha B'Av, and maybe that's why it becomes the fifth tragedy of Tisha B'Av, because the Jews were reminded of it every single year when they made pilgrimage to mourn. So let me conclude. We'll leave the appreciation of Rabbi Akiva for another time, but let me just conclude by bringing this to kind of modern relevance. The Mishnah starts out by telling us about five tragedies of Jewish history, and we know how many more have been added on. We live in a time where we have been privileged to see, if not the reversal of many of these, we have been privileged to see the hand of God, maybe even divine countenance, in turning the direction of Jewish history. And I think understanding the fifth tragedy of Jewish history as the lingering presence of a foreign power and a foreign religion on the site of the city of Yerushalayim actually helps us with some nechama, which is really in many ways the theme of Tisha B'Av afternoon. Because if you think about it, of the five tragedies, the first one was the Jewish people turning their back on the gift of the land of Israel. And we're so privileged to live at a time where we too have been offered the gift of the land of Israel. And thankfully, though it could be debated, we should do so even more vigorously, but thankfully, we have not abandoned that. We have responded to that challenge. We have built an amazing state of Israel, which promises to be the site of the Jewish future. The fourth tragedy was the defeat of Beitar. And as I mentioned, Beitar was the last time before 1948 that Jews fought for the Jewish people and for the land of Israel. And how privileged are we in our own time to have seen the next reincarnation of the Jewish people fighting for the Jewish people in a Jewish army for the land of Israel. And understanding the fifth tragedy as the presence of a foreign power and a foreign religion on the site of Yerushalayim, so after 1967, we too can take a great deal of nechama at being part of the generation that has seen Jerusalem restored and reunited as a Jewish city with Judaism sitting at its heart. And that, of course, leads us to the last two tragedies, which we have not yet seen nechama for, and that's what we continue to yearn for every single Tisha B'Av, and that is the rebuilding of a Beit HaMikdash b'mehirah v'yameinu.